Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
The program is a very detailed introduction of Ron Reagan. I'm not going to go over all of that because it's a literate audience and I'm sure you can read it. It gives his extensive background in media, both in radio and in television and in a lot of national publications. But I'm going to add a couple footnotes that give a little bit of flavor that's not in the biography. Many of you may know this, but I'm just going to share it with you anyhow. He is the liberal son of the conservative icon. Who at age 12 announced that he was an atheist. That must have created very, very interesting dinner conversations at the family table. He also went his own way several years later. After one semester at Yale, he dropped out to become a ballet dancer and performed with the internationally renowned Joffrey Ballet. He is the only child of a U.S. president who hosted Saturday Night Live. And he mows his own lawn. And I know the other stuff we'll get to, but do you really mow your own lawn?
I do, yes. I mow my lawn, but I'm smart about it now. I took out the front lawns. And the lawn on the parking strip, which you're also responsible for mowing in Seattle. So it's only the backyard that I have to mow now. Now we have native grasses planted.
And this is therapeutic for you? Or?
No, it's just necessary to keep the lawn from getting too long.
Let's talk about your book.
Okay.
Everyone here knows Ronald Reagan as the governor of California and as the president of the United States. You knew him as Dad.
That's right, yes.
But you wrote this book to find him. Mm-hmm. What did you find that you didn't know?
Well, my father is, as I say in the book, the 90% of him that you all know, and of course I knew, is right out there, and it's what you see is what you get. The same man that would stand up and give speeches or, you know, read an address to the camera when the Challenger went down or any of that kind of thing was the same man we saw around the dinner table. But those of us who knew him very well and were very close to him were aware that there was a metaphorical 10% that he kept very closely guarded, a solitary kind of core. And it was that core that I really wanted to go looking for. Even my mother, who is, of course, knew him as well better than anybody and for quite some time, admitted that she could often not penetrate that last 10%, if you will. It seemed to me likely that the origin, the genesis of that solitary Ronald Reagan must have happened back in his youth, in his formative years, 100 years ago. It was that 100 years that really got me into the book when I was talking to my mother about on the occasion of his 99th birthday, and she said, can you believe Daddy's going to be 100 next year? She calls him Daddy, of course, to her kids still. And I was saying things like, yes, isn't that remarkable? 100! Amazing! Inside, I was thinking, oh, God, not another aircraft carrier. You know, please don't make me christen a bridge or something, you know, over this. And I'd never really wanted to write a book about my father. I certainly didn't want to do it while he was in office. That would be just exploitive. And I was aware that many other people have written books about him, including every member of my family. In some cases, I've lost track of how many books they've written. But that was the window in. That 100 years was the door that I could go through to get to him and that changed my mind. And it seemed to me, as I said, that isolate core at his center, the one that we couldn't quite penetrate all the time, had to have been born way back then in another world, 1911. You know, think about 1911, small town, Midwest. First thing I did when I started working on the book was I went to the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley. It's much easier to do this sort of thing, by the way, when you've got a whole like institution that's, you know, with all sorts of research there, and you know, you've had Pulitzer Prize winning biographers spend 14 years tailing him around and doing just mountains of research. It's kind of laid out for you there. A lot of the facts are there. But I went to the library and I said, bring me anything you've got on his early life. Photographs, transcripts from in a school, yearbooks, anything. So out come these boxes from the back. And I put on my white gloves, because you have to, and I start looking through this file of photographs that are from the 19th century. You can tell, they're kind of sepia tone. And two photographs in particular captured my attention right away. They were of Tampico, Illinois, which is the town where he was born on February 6th, 1911. And there was writing in the margins on the bottom. And they were of two different sides of Main Street, the west side and the east side. And somebody, who I later discovered, or rather quickly discovered or determined, was my grandmother Nellie, his mother, had written on the bottom of one, suppose you know that fellow in his shirt sleeves. And I look at the photograph, and there standing in the doorway of a dry goods store, which turns out to be the H.C. Pitney store in Tampico, Illinois, is a man in his shirt sleeves, and I look closer, and I realize, my God, that's my grandfather, who just happened to be standing in the doorway of his store when this photographer set up in the middle of the street and took this picture. And there he is, standing there in his shirt sleeves with his thick head of hair and his dark complexion. He was a very dark-complected guy. Now the camera swings over to the east side of the street, and Nellie has written, Jack put the X over the wrong apartment, so I crossed it out and marked the right one. So she's put an X over the apartment where my father was born and where they briefly lived. And she writes further, just imagine you see me with my head stuck out the window. And I thought, and I did, I tried to imagine her looking out, but then I looked at the street. I looked at what she would be seeing when she stuck her head out the window. There was not an automobile in sight. Every vehicle in evidence was a horse-drawn cart or wagon. The street was dirt. It looked like Dodge City Midwest Edition. And this was the world into which my father was born. He did not wake up in the mornings to the sound of engines revving or buses, you know, going or anything like that. It was hooves stamping in the street and the jingling of bridles and that sort of thing, the creak of wooden wagon wheels.
Were there any surprises that you found?
Well, most of us think of my father, I think, whatever we may think of his politics, and I was determined that this is not going to be a political book. I'm not the person to do that in any case, and I had no interest in that. But most of us think of him as a sort of big, strapping, confident guy, you know, very, you know, forceful. But when he was a small boy, he was undersized. He was a little boy. I've seen these pictures of him. He's a little shrimp. And this family, of course, moved around a lot, so he was often the new boy in school. And he was picked on by bullies who would chase him home after school in the afternoons. He was often chosen last for games. Loved to play, loved to hurl himself about, but he was so small and so much the new kid that he'd get picked last. Nobody wanted him. Plus, he was really nearsighted. Couldn't see a thing. You know, he didn't know it at the time. He thought everybody saw the world as a sort of blur. It wasn't until he was, I think probably around 12 or 13, and he was out driving with his parents in their Model T, and everybody else could read the road signs, but he couldn't. And he didn't understand why this was, and his mother took off her glasses and gave them to him. And he put them on, and all of a sudden the world had a horizon line. You know, all of a sudden trees had leaves on them. They weren't just kind of blobby green things. It's not that I discovered a whole bunch of things I just didn't know. It wasn't like I, you know, my God, he was a cross-dressing serial killer in his youth, you know. But I certainly have a new appreciation for the solitary little boy that he became. He began to spend a lot of time by himself, often, in the home in Galesburg that they rented briefly, in the attic there. The previous owner had left a bunch of relics behind, just detritus, things, relics from the West often. Many of them were natural objects from the West, and he became fascinated with that. And he would spend hours up there in these dusty sunbeams, you know, poring over these things and imagining himself in this strange, alien, wide-open Western landscape, and beginning to create his internal narrative, beginning to create a story. Came from a line of storytellers, and he was a storyteller. And his great opus was himself. He created his personal narrative as a template for his life. Not as a, I'm going to pretend to be this and kind of get over on people that way, but as a, this is what I want to be. I want to be a hero. But it has to mean something. I want to be a real hero. Not just a person that people call hero, not a fake hero. A real hero. And so he began to create this template for his life, and I think he continued for his entire life doing that.
What is your favorite personal memory of him?
Well, there are a number. I mean, you know, I have old memories, of course, from my, you know, early childhood. Some of my first memories of him are him picking me up at night when it was bedtime and flying me to my bedroom, you know, dipping under the door jams and you know, making the little propeller sound and things, and then settling me down into bed, and he'd sing a little, you know, a little rhyme to me. So there's that. And then there's, you know, there are memories, funny memories, I think, from later on. He's well known for his capacity for denial. You know, certain unpleasant aspects of life, he would try to sort of hold off. My wife and I once were riding back in the presidential limousine from some event or another. I can't remember what it was, but must have been a big event because there were people lining the streets to watch the motorcade go by. And at this point in his presidency, he had decided that he was going to start reviving the thumbs-up gesture. He thought America needed more thumbs-up. So he'd been going around the country thumbs-upping people everywhere, you know. And he was doing this out the window as we went by. He was still thumbs-upping. At some point along the route, a youngish man, maybe in his 30s or so, sneaks under the sawhorses, you know, past the police tape, breaks through the, you know, the cordon of guard, whatever. I don't know how he did it, but he managed to get within, you know, a couple of body lengths, basically, of the limo on my father's side. He was promoting a different hand gesture. And while you couldn't hear what he was actually saying through the bulletproof glass, my lip reading skills told me that it began with mother and ended with another ER syllable. And my father catches this guy, he's right there, this snarling, ah! You know. And my father is looking at this, and without missing a beat, he turns to us in the car and says, "You see, I think it's catching on." That was my dad.
That was your dad. Now, it couldn't have all been perfect. So what was the most difficult father-son moment you had?
Well, I describe a couple of moments in the book. There was one in particular. My father was not at all a corporal punishment sort of guy. I mean, he never hit us. Well, there was that one little tap on the cheek to Patty, my sister Patty, when she made the mistake of saying, "Jesus Christ, Dad," when she was mad at him. He, "Don't take the Lord's name in vain," and he gave her a little, you know, like this. I was in the car for that. But he didn't yell. He didn't get the belt out, you know, none of that kind of stuff. He'd just make you feel kind of small by increasing the sort of gravitas in his voice as he talked to you. And, you know, he'd slow down and he actually gets softer. You know, the more kind of frantic you got and crazy you got, the softer and slower he'd get until you just felt like a maniac, you know, and he was so calm. And all this. But there was one incident I remember, and I just mentioned it in the book, where we were fighting about something at the dinner table. I was kind of in my late teens and not long for the household. I moved out of the house at 18 and never went back, so and began working for a living then. But we were fighting about something, and I decided I'd had enough because it was sort of a two-on-one thing. You know, he was tag-teaming with my mother, and, you know, this was getting uncomfortable. I'm going for a drive. I'm out of here. And he didn't want me walking away, and so he, you know, you sit right back down here, and I, nope, see ya. You know, headed for the front door, and I hear him coming after me down the living room. He knocked his chair over, I think, as he left the dining room table. And I'd reached the front door when I turned around and saw him coming down the living room after me. He was wearing his pajamas and robe, which did tend to kind of mitigate the menace a little bit. You know, I mentioned there was something kind of endearing even in that moment as I watched him kind of coming down there with his robe flapping and his little PJs and things like that. But I noticed as he reached our front hall, which was slate, that his right fist had curled. Now, you know, he was by that time in his 60s, but he's, you know, you don't want him hitting you. You know, he's a big guy. And so I remember instinctively, just in a defensive gesture, taking a half step toward him and putting my hand on his chest. And he was in his slippers on the slate, and this caught him off guard, and he, you know, kind of went backwards like this with this very startled expression on his face, because I wasn't expecting the curled fist, and he wasn't expecting the palm in the chest either. And I took advantage of that and ducked out the door. But I felt bad about that whole altercation and that interaction, and so I went to my mother afterwards and I said, you know, I'm never going to hit him, but I don't want him hitting me either. So can you arrange a kind of a detente here where we can agree to that? And she did, and he was quite relieved. I could tell he'd probably forgotten at that point, but you know what we were originally fighting about, and I think we were probably both of us most concerned that it had almost escalated to something physical. I don't think he was actually going to punch me, but
there was another moment you described in the book that I was very taken with. It was age 12, the same time you became an atheist, that you beat him in a backyard swimming contest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we would have these swimming races from the time I was quite small, and he was a hell of a swimmer, I have to say. You know, his fanatic sports interest when he was in college was football. He just, he desperately wanted to be a great football player. And his hero, Harland Wagoner from Dixon, Illinois, was the big hero of the Dixon High football team. And a few years before my father went to Eureka College and, you know, earned a varsity letter in all 4 years there playing at Eureka. And my dad figured that he was going to follow in Harland Wagoner's footsteps. And unfortunately, he couldn't see very well and he wasn't very fast. And so that left him playing on the line. Well, he weighed 175 pounds. So you can imagine he spent a lot of time being battered about by people who were much larger than he was. But he went towards football because that's where you got a claim. But his real talent was swimming. But who swam? You know, nobody would come to your swim meets or anything. You didn't get a big celebrity. Maybe if you were Johnny Weissmuller. But swimming just wasn't, an avenue to acclaim in those days. Nevertheless, he was a fabulous swimmer and a great lifeguard, of course, at Lowell Park and on the Rock River. But we would swim. We would have these races all the time. And he would explain to me once that he was not going to let me win. He was going to make me feel good by letting me win because at some point I was going to beat him. He knew that I would beat him. He imagined, I think, that I would be like, you know, a senior coming out of college or something.
35.
Yeah, and he was 100 or whatever. But so he wouldn't let me win. He wouldn't rub my nose in it. He'd slow down and make it fun and everything. But he'd always
win.
Yes. So age 12 comes, and we're going to have another swimming race up and down the pool, as we usually do. And my mother sets us off, on your mark, get set, go. And down the pool we go, and I'm noticing that we're pretty even. And when we get to the end of the pool, I'd spent a previous year on a swim team, local swim team in Sacramento, and I'd learned a flip turn. A flip turn is not something that he did in his day. They didn't have flip turns then. So I hit that wall, and I roll into this turn, and I just happen to hit it just right, and I take off heading the other way, and now I'm a body length ahead of him. And I can see him kicking hard. I can see that froth, you know, at his heels. He's really pulling because he sees it too. And I can imagine the jolt of adrenaline going through him that his 12-year-old is now beating him. But he couldn't catch me. I beat him down the pool. And, you know, to me it was just, hey, I finally won. And, you know, back to the deep end and, you know, playing Lloyd Bridges and Sea Hunt.
But you saw something in your mother's face.
Yes, I did. I could see it in her face, and I could see it in his. He congratulated me, of course. Well, that was a fine race. But I watched him climb out of the pool and saw her drape a towel over his shoulders. And I realized it was a bigger moment for him, I think, than it was for me, in a way. But he did find a way to make it a win-win situation. Later that night at dinner, now, say, did you do one of those flip turns? I said, yeah, I did. Ah, well, you see, we didn't have flip turns in my day. So now he'd made it excusable for himself to lose. He didn't take the win away from me. He wasn't going to do that. I'd won fair and square, but there was this asterisk that had been appended to the race that allowed him to feel better about the whole thing. We never raced again, by the way. That was the end of it.
What you described in the book, though, was your mother was happy for you, but you also saw a sadness. Now,
well, she understood what was happening.
They were reputed to be very, very close.
They were.
Was there room? How did children fit into that relationship when the parents were that close?
Well, I think, you know, as a child, you're very jealous of your parents in the sense that you want all of them. And since my father would keep that 10%, you know, somewhat closely guarded, you were aware after a while that was there and that you were not quite getting to that. And so that could bother you. It is true that, you know, they were clearly the most important people in each other's lives. And as a child, often you want to be the most important person in everybody's life, I suppose, but certainly your parents. And so that, yes, I was conscious of that. I think my siblings maybe felt that more than I did and have written about it, and obviously it troubled them more. I felt like I got a lot of my parents. I lived alone with them for a lot of the time. I was the youngest. I was the baby of the family, and other kids would go to boarding school and everything, and so I had lots of him, so I didn't feel that I was missing a whole lot.
You, I think, in the book, described your relationship with him as crowded.
Well, yes. When he became governor of California, all of a sudden, all these staff people show up, you know, and all of a sudden, there's this new group of people who seem to have a claim on his attention. I used to think of them, when I was a kid, as indoor people. Because he and I, most of our relationship, a lot of it took place outdoors, swimming in the ocean and pools, riding horses through the woods, playing football out in the front lawn. And these were indoor people. These were political people. They were political consultants, staff members. They tended to be kind of pallid, you know, and smoke and wear rumpled suits and things, you know. You think Lynn Nofziger, John right. Sears, these kind of, I don't know if you remember these people, but, you know.
Very indoor.
They seem, they seem kind of
pasty white.
Unhealthy in a way. But they clearly had a claim on his attention, and they clearly had skills that as an 8-year-old I couldn't match. But I always knew that, you know, in the realm outdoors, that I had primacy there. That was my territory, and they had no real standing there.
In talking about your family, I was very taken aback by your half-brother Michael's response to your book. Were you?
Well, I probably wasn't as surprised as I should have been, but I suppose I owe him a thank you note for so enthusiastically promoting my book.
By the way, it opened number 13 on the New York Times bestsellers list.
He probably would have done better to have read it before he began talking about it, but he didn't. I think some of the confusion, the controversy, as I'm sure you well know, is it surrounds Alzheimer's and the presidency and whether he, in fact, had the disease while he was president. I make a couple of observations in the book. There's very little in the book about this, but it is there. Two things I say. I noticed, you know, midway through his two terms as president, I began to notice occasionally little somethings that I couldn't quite explain. Now, you know, you got to remember he was the oldest president ever elected at the time. He was in his mid-70s by that time. He was losing his hearing and did not like to wear hearing aids. And he'd been shot and nearly killed, which will take a little of the wind out of your sails. I don't apply the name Alzheimer's to my worry in the book, and I didn't think about it that way when I was worrying about him. I was just worried. He's in this terribly stressful job. He's 70-some-odd years old, and you're thinking, geez, you know, this is tough. The one incident that I cite there is the first Mondale debate in 1984, where he really obviously had a bad night. I don't know why he had a bad night, and I don't offer, you know, Alzheimer's as an explanation for that, but something was off for him. And immediately everybody began to talk about, well, he's too old, he's lost a step, you know, we can't elect people to the presidency this old, and, you know,
but the next debate
he comes back and cleans house.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I was actually there for that one. I determined to go to that one because I was worried about him. I thought, you know, he can't have another bad night like that. You know, that's really going to damage his prospects. And even though I was a liberal and probably would have voted for Mondale if it was, you know, if my father wasn't my father, he was my father. And I'm damned if I'm voting for anybody else. You know, he's my dad. Of course I'm supporting him, and I figure I can change his mind once he gets back into the White House. I can work on him. You know, I've got an in there. So he was back. The other thing I say, which I think is probably been even more misinterpreted, is that given when he was diagnosed a few years out of office, and given what we now know, didn't know then, but now know about Alzheimer's disease, which is that it is a process which unfolds for years, even we now believe decades, before actual symptoms arise, you know, diagnosable symptoms arise, that it is likely that the disease was present in him while he was president. Now, I think some people confuse Alzheimer's, the disease, and dementia, a symptom of later stage Alzheimer's. I mentioned in the book that I didn't see any dementia-like symptoms in him when he was president. But some people hear Alzheimer's and they just think dementia. So they think that what I'm saying is he was suffering from dementia, likely suffering from dementia, in the White House, and that's just not what I say. And I don't think that this deduction that the disease was probably present in him, and I've talked to doctors about this who've concurred that that is, given what we know, that virtually must be the case. You know, that gets misunderstood and misinterpreted.
Were you surprised by the furor that this misinterpretation created?
A little bit. I mean, when I understood that Mike had come out and said what he had said, I understood, you know, because having worked in news organizations before and on television and all.
It seemed like taking sibling rivalry to a new level.
Well, yeah, I suppose. Yeah, Mike sometimes bears his Freudian soul, you know, in ways that I don't think he realizes. But, you know, I understood that there would be some reaction to this. The level of it kind of surprised me. But once an organization has a news hook, they're going to run with it. And they're not going to let it go, as I've discovered. I've spent the last week and a half explaining to people that I really didn't write what you're telling me I did, and asking them to show it to me in the book. Well, of course they can't. You know, at one point I was being told that I had posited this this brain surgery that he had had at some point. He had one procedure in 1989 after he was thrown from a horse, and this was the first,
right. That's,
you know,
when it was
inkling
first,
that
inkling
he might have Alzheimer's. Right. They suspected there might be Alzheimer's there. Thrown from a horse in Mexico, July 4th, 1989. He makes two medical stops, one in Tucson, which I mistakenly refer to as San Diego in the book. You know, who doesn't fact-check cities? Cuff me about the head and shoulders. We caught it too late after it went to the printer. But anyway, Tucson, they kind of patch him up a little. But then 2 months later, goes to the Mayo Clinic, and they burr a hole in the skull, you know, when they need to relieve the pressure of fluid that is built up from a blow to the head. That's the only surgery that I mention in the book. But somehow I was being told that I had written about some other surgery. And I'd say, where?
Let's go back to, you mentioned, you know, he had been shot. And in your book, you talked about seeing him shot on in a TV movie when you were a little kid.
Yeah,
and
I can't
how disturbed you were about that. Yeah. And it's got to have been unbelievable deja vu when we all remember watching in horror as John Hinckley shot him for real.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I can't remember whether it was the Killers or, oh God, what was the Western? Now I'm forgetting. I'm blanking on the name of the Western. It's in the book, but never mind. It's all right. But Tennessee's Partner, two movies where he was shot. And yes, when I was very small, I saw this on TV, and I was just, you know, beside myself. Daddy, you know, Daddy's been shot, and I had to be talked down and, you know, explained about acting versus reality. But in when it is real, it's, of course, much worse, much worse, yeah.
And at the time of the shooting, he was still opposed to gun control, but changed his position years later and supported the Brady bill.
Brady, his press secretary,
right,
who was shot in the head, Jim Brady.
Do you know what transposed during that period of time that he
It was the fact that he knew Jim Brady, and Jim Brady had been shot, and the guy who shot Jim Brady was really shooting at my father, and so my father felt responsible for this. And could not resist Jim Brady and his wife and their legislation. He might have been reluctant otherwise, but now that issue was personalized for him. Now it had a face. Now it had a body, and the body had a bullet fired through it.
So you don't think he really changed his position? It was more personal support for...
That was the key for my father. If people or issues were abstract, he could react in one way. If you put a face to them, if they became personal, they were something altogether different for him. And I think ultimately, you know, it was possible that some of his advisors could even manipulate him to a certain extent by keeping something abstract for him or personalizing it. I didn't write about this in the book, but there's, and I wasn't there at the time, but I've heard this story a number of times, and I'm sure it's probably true. It sounds just like him anyway. Most people think, well, you know, he was kind of cruel to the poor and, you know, all the welfare queen tropes and all that sort of stuff and, you know, hard-hearted towards people who were disadvantaged. And I can understand that perception. On the other hand, again, if it was personalized, it was entirely different. There was an evening when he was in the White House and he was watching the local news in D.C., and a young woman was on there, and it was a hard luck story. She was a young mother, unwed, and, you know, getting thrown out of her apartment and whatever. And he went back to his desk in the living quarters of the White House, pulled out his personal checkbook, and wrote her a check for $2,000, sent it to her. A couple of days later, he's watching the local news again, and there she is on TV again with a framed copy of a check from the President of the United States that she's now putting on her wall. So he goes back to his desk, gets his checkbook out, and writes her another check for $2,000, sends it to her with a note saying, cash this one. This is, you know, so, but, you know, she had a face. She was a person there, and he wanted to help.
You know. When he left office, he had an unbelievably high approval rating, 64%, which was the highest of a departing president since Franklin Roosevelt. And then he was older and maybe less engaged. To what do you attribute that political magic of people just loved him?
His character. You know, again, I disagreed with him politically about things. I'm sure some of you did as well. But you never doubted that he had a sterling character, that he meant what he said what he meant. He always was doing his best for the country. He was a man without cynicism and without guile. And, you know, again, you could disagree with him, but I never doubted that he really meant the best all the time and was doing his best for other people.
And so you think that was the magic?
Well, yes, I think people get that. Television is very revealing, and of course he used television very well, and he was aware that it was revealing, but you can't manipulate that. I mean, the camera is right there in your face, and people are very good at reading faces and reading character through faces. So your face doesn't lie, in a sense. And so I think people got that. They got that about him, his fundamental decency. And we're so used to politicians, certainly today, saying things that you know they don't mean. You can tell again just by looking at their face when they're saying it, looking into their eyes, that they're not, you know, they don't mean what they say. They're just running their mouths for political advantage. And, you know, he wasn't like that. He was different.
He is, to this day, an icon or a deity of the conservative movement. And his legacy sometimes seems to be twisted to the people are using it to their own advantage. What do you think he would make of how people bandy his name about?
Well, I don't know. He'd probably be flattered to be mentioned, of course, because he was susceptible to
flattery. So he's not rolling over in his grave.
I don't know that he's rolling over in his grave about that exactly. I think he would be very upset at some of the vitriol that's being directed, say, at the White House. He's not the sort of guy who's going to be painting a Hitler mustache on a portrait of the president. You know, he would think that that was really beneath us as a nation and a people, that kind of, you know, mudslinging.
Barack Obama took Lou Cannon's book with him to Hawaii on vacation to read about your father. Mm-hmm. Do you see any similarities between the two men?
Well, yes, they're both very good speakers. I think one thing Barack Obama might take from my father. They're both willing to compromise. My father was famously said, "If I can get 80% of what I want, that's pretty good. You know, I'm willing to negotiate on that other 20%, certainly." And I think Barack Obama seems to be, you know, very much in that mold. I think where he may learn from my father is that, however amenable he might have been to compromise, rhetorically he was always straight ahead. You never doubted where he wanted to go, how he felt about things. He didn't mince words in that way. He didn't sort of withdraw from the argument and let the thing play out in Congress. You know, if he had wanted a public option in a health care bill, you'd have been hearing a lot about a public option in a health care bill. You know, and he wouldn't, you know, back off on that. He might negotiate it away eventually because he had to get the bill passed, but you'd know that he really wanted it in there.
Do you think that's the way to get 80% of what you want?
I think you make a mistake when you give away the store before you start negotiating. I mean, if you, you know, why go to Big Pharma and the health insurance industry, for instance, before you start negotiating in Congress over your health bill and essentially ask their permission to do things? You know, what will you let me do and what won't you let? Where are your red lines here? I have a hard time seeing my father do something comparable to that. I think it's a mistake to do it. I think you need to use the bully pulpit to get what you want. If you think it's right, you need to fight for it. Again, you may have to compromise eventually, but you need to fight for it, for God's sake, you know. It's important.
Good point.
Well,
have you thought about going into the family business?
No. It's not really the family. You mean acting?
Yes.
Done a little acting.
How many here in this audience saw this distinguished gentleman do the underwear dance on Saturday Night Live? And he did it way better than Tom Cruise.
My parents were a little, yes. Yeah, right. I had to wear 3 pairs of jockey shorts for that. We, in the dress rehearsal, the NBC censors insisted on 2 for the dress rehearsal, but after viewing that videotape, they said, maybe 3. We don't want any, it was live television. They didn't want any, you know, any unexpected appearances.
Was it fun doing it?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, it was fun. My parents were completely baffled by it, of course, you know, because they'd never seen Risky Business. They didn't know who Tom Cruise was, and they just wondered, what the hell are you doing in your underwear? Dancing around in your underwear here.
So, had they watched Saturday Night Live?
Oh, I don't think they'd ever watched it before. Yeah, that was not really their kind of TV viewing. They were more Lawrence Welk kind of people, you know.
Although you missed that horrible glare of the Beltway growing up, you didn't, you know, you missed the Amy Carter.
Oh yeah,
Chelsea,
I was 22
experience.
When I was elected. And I was married.
You must have had a couple of fun experiences at the White House.
Oh yeah, I mean the White House is, you know, it's a fun place to visit. Wouldn't want to live there. You know, truly, it's like a 5-star hotel, but you have no privacy. It's a public building. You know, you look out the windows, and there are a bunch of people lining the fences with cameras. You know, there's, you know, like this. So you don't really feel like, you know. hanging out there all that much. I remember one of the first times I visited, though, I flew down from New York to National Airport, now Reagan National Airport. I thought it was big of them to name an airport after me.
Did you get to do champagne on that one? The naming of the airport, did you get to break a bottle of champagne?
I didn't break the champagne on that one either. No, but I was going to fly down, and you know, they told me a car will meet you at the airport, and so I went to the baggage claim, and there was nobody there, and I went outside, and there was nobody there. So I thought, well, okay, I'll take a cab. So got in a cab, where are you going? 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He unfazed. Dropped me off in front of the White House at the curb, you know, with my backpack. And now I thought, I wonder how this is going to go, you know. But I walked up to the little guard booth there at the gate, and the guy just looked at me and said, "Oh, hi, Ron. Go on in." And that was it. You know, I was in. Yeah.
Now the former presidents get together. Do any of the kids of the former presidents get together?
No, not that I'm aware
of.
Have
you met any of the other?
Yes, I've met some. I've met Chelsea. I've met some of the Fords, though I can't remember now which. I've met some of the Bushes, certainly.
Do you share
president.
Stories?
Not I don't know.
No,
I haven't spent a lot of time with
them. Really juicy today.
I haven't spent a lot of time with them. I did meet George W. Bush at my father's memorial service in Washington when we brought him back there. I was not impressed. He's not 6 feet tall. I can tell you that. He's advertised as 6 feet tall. I'm 6 feet tall, and I was looking down at him. So,
was he wearing his boots?
No, he wasn't wearing his cowboy boots that day. That might have brought him up a couple inches or so, but he was not. He didn't. And I have to say, and maybe rude, but I didn't call him Mr. President when I met him. I called him Mr. Bush. How do you do, Mr. Bush? This is not improper, exactly, because in our democratic society, anybody is entitled to be called Mr. So-and-so. It is traditional to call the president Mr. President, but you can call him Mr. Bush or Mr. whatever else, so I chose to do that, and he had probably heard some of the things I'd said about him on the radio and in print. I was not a big fan of his, and he shook my hand, and I, you know, said, "How do you do?" And he moved on down the line. It was kind of a little semicircle of our family, and he was just shaking everybody's hands. And at one point, he kind of turned back to me, like he, you know, he realized that I hadn't called him Mr. President or something. He kind of looked back at me like that, and I was in really no mood at that point. My father had just died, and you know, who was this guy, frankly? And so I just looked at him, and he kind of. And he just went back to shaking hands and stuff. And I thought, oh, great, you know. If I'm kicking his ass, you know, what's Vladimir Putin going to do? You know, so.
Here's what I really like. If you had one more afternoon with your father, what would you say to him?
I think I would ask him about his father. He had a somewhat conflicted relationship with his father. And an unresolved relationship, and I would want to know more about that. I would want to know more about Jack. Jack sometimes gets edited out of the story in an odd way, and I mentioned this
because
in the
he
book.
Was a Democrat.
Oh no! No, my father was a Democrat. Throughout the time I'm writing about him, for the most part, he was a Democrat too, a Roosevelt Democrat, like his parents. But Jack drank. He was not an alcoholic, I don't think. I think he gets a little bit of a raw deal. He's portrayed as an alcoholic, but he wasn't. He drank like many men back in the 1920s during Prohibition drank, much more than most men do or people do today. But there's a story, for instance, it's an the iconic story, really, of my father's early youth, where he comes home one winter night. In 1922, he's just turned 11 years old, and he, as he approaches their house on Hennepin Avenue in Dixon, Illinois, he notices that there's this dark shape at the doorstep. And as he gets closer, he realizes it's his father, passed out, drunk, cruciform, laying in the snow, burping up corn whiskey. And as he tells it, his first impulse is to simply step over him and go inside and ignore this. He's been ignoring it his whole life, this mother and father having fights over Jack's drinking and things like that. He just pulls the covers over his head and, you know, goes back to his Edgar Rice Burroughs books and things like that. But now here it is right at his feet, literally. And so in his telling, he seizes the initiative here, his coming-of-age moment. He mans up and he grabs his father's coat collar and he drags him over the threshold of the house and he somehow muscles him up this narrow angled stairway that I've now visited and seen and puts him to bed and then goes downstairs. And when Nellie, his mother, comes home, he doesn't say a word to her, as if she wouldn't know when she finds her drunken husband in bed. Now I went back and I thought about this, and I thought about him as an undersized little boy and Jack as a pretty burly guy, probably 180 pounds or so. And I realized he didn't drag anybody anywhere. He certainly didn't muscle anybody up those narrow stairs. I'm sure he found his father there on the doorstep, and I'm sure he grabbed him by the coat. Maybe he was crying, or maybe he'd already retreated into himself, but he probably shook him awake, and Jack would have staggered to his feet. And Jack being Jack, he probably would have had some pithy things to say. Probably profane things to say, but you don't hear any of that in the story. Jack is edited out of the story because this is my father's coming-of-age story, narrative, and it wouldn't do to give Jack too many lines. It would distract from the focus of the story, which is my father in his telling.
And if you got this extra half a day with him, mm-hmm. what would you do? What would you two do together?
Oh, we'd probably go riding horses or something. Or maybe go for a swim. Mm-hmm. Depend.
Would you let him
maybe
win?
Maybe wouldn't waste the
would
time.
Would you let him win?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Maybe he wouldn't want me to, though.
Maybe not. There's at least a half a dozen questions in here that ask how your mother is.
Oh, she's fine. She'll be 90 on July 6th. Sharp as a tack. She appears to like the book, which was encouraging, particularly after some of my family members apparently didn't
get their 15 minutes.
Well, maybe. Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, that's it. But I asked her about it after all that stuff blew up. I called her and I said, you know, I'm going to be asked what you think of the book, and I don't want to ascribe sentiments to you that you may not have. Other people might do that, but I'm not going to do it. So just tell me what you want me to say when I'm asked. And she said, you tell them I read it, I loved it, it made me cry, and I'm very proud of you.
What most did you admire about your dad?
Kindness. He used to say a gentleman always does the kind thing. And I think kindness is really an underrated virtue. He treated everybody the same. The guy that shined his shoes at the barber shop, or the Queen of England, or you know whoever it might be, they were all treated the same way. I never saw him bluster. He was not one of those men who would come home, you know, kind of angry one night and talk about you know kicking somebody's ass if they ever hang down again. And never gossiped. He was utterly without cynicism or guile. To an almost strange degree, really. I mean, he was, you know, as I say in the book, almost like he was too good. Like, what planet did you come from? You know, you felt a little ashamed to bring any kind of absurdity or, you know, sarcasm or anything into the house because it would produce, you know, psychological disequilibrium in him. So kindness would be something. He was also very aware of his physical surroundings, which, you know, children are too. I mean, children are very into the physical world. And so when I was little, I admired the fact that he seemed to be too, whereas all these indoor people, for instance, not so much. They seemed to be just oblivious to all kinds of stuff that was going on. It's like, do they even know there's such a thing as weather, you know? I mean, do they go outside? Would they notice? But he did, and there's the one story, of course, of him pulling a little girl out of our swimming pool in Sacramento. Every year when he was governor of California, they had these big parties in this backyard of a rented house. We rented a house in Sacramento when he was governor. And it had a good-sized pool in it. It was a big backyard. And he'd have these parties for legislators or the members of the media. And there'd be 200 people out there. And they'd bring their kids. They'd bring their families and stuff. And so the pool would be filled with children playing. Well, with that going on, that became his top priority. He's the governor, and he's supposed to be schmoozing people and, you know, networking and doing business, basically, at this party. But not when there's people in the water. He's the lifeguard. The lifeguard. And so there he is. He's parked himself by the edge of the pool, and he's having conversations. People are sort of coming to him at the edge of the pool because he doesn't want to leave it away. And he notices this little girl who goes to the bottom. Now, this is in the midst of, you know, realistically probably 20 or 30 kids in the pool, but he notices her go down. And he gives her, I'm guessing he probably gave her about 10 seconds to come back up, and she didn't. And he very politely just excused himself from the conversation and, fully clothed, just dove into the water and dove down, scooped her up off the bottom and brought her back to the side. There's a photograph in the book of him standing there up to his waist in the water with this little girl looking somewhat dazed and her mother and my mother, you know, kind of around her with towels and things. And her father, actually, I have to say, in the back, I feel kind of sorry for him now, her father in the background looking relieved, I suppose, that his daughter didn't drown, but a little ashamed that he didn't save her, and this guy that I don't think he really liked my father. You know, that this guy had, while he was freshening his piña colada, as I say, that, you know, my father was rescuing his daughter. So anyway, awareness, that would be another one. Yeah.
There's a lot of questions in this pile about what your father would think of the Tea Party, and I know you don't like to put words in his mouth.
No.
So maybe what I should ask you is what you think of the Tea Party.
Well, I understand why people would think that he might identify with him. He certainly was a low-tax, small-government kind of guy in a general sense. You remember that for most of his presidency, the top marginal tax rate was 50%. So he might be pretty satisfied with where the tax rate is now. But I don't like to speak to issues, you know, in his voice. I don't know how his thinking would have evolved over the years. We live in different times now. I do think that he would be upset by the vitriol, though, of many of the Tea Party members and the kind of, you know, some of those unfortunate signs that would show up. I think the idea, too, of bringing a gun to a political rally would, you know, I mean, I grew up with guns. He had guns in the house and stuff, but they've become such a fetish object for some people there, as if the entire Constitution is really all about, you know, your God-given right to carry a concealed weapon into a bar. You know, I mean, really, you know, are you that challenged in a penile sense that, you know, you're so desperate to get your hands on a gun? It is. We fetishize violence and guns in this country to an alarming degree. That was really, to me, the Gabby Giffords shooting. This man was insane. You can't, you know, blame his madness on Sarah Palin or something like that. But it's the context in which he acted where politicians are calling for Second Amendment solutions if they don't get their way at the ballot box. That's not how democracy is supposed to work. We have elections here. If if your candidate doesn't get elected, well, work harder next time and maybe he or she will be. But you don't take to the streets with guns because more people voted for the other guy or girl, for that matter. So this is, it's very disturbing.
Was there a particular moment in your life when you recognized that you had divergent political opinions from your father? Or did it evolve?
Pretty much when I hit puberty. I mean, that was when I, 12 was a big year, swimming race and atheism, and we started arguing about environmental issues and things. I remember, I didn't tell this story in the book either, but when I was even smaller, I must have been 10 years old, and we were watching television in Sacramento, and there was this nature special on, and it was about polar bears, and they were talking about people hunting polar bears. And they had this shot of apparent hunters shooting a mother polar bear and her cubs, you know, kind of at the body and everything. And I was just devastated. I was crying. I was, you know, like, how could they do this? And my father didn't know what to say. You know, the thrust of the program was endangered species. We need to protect these animals and stop this, you know, slaughter of animals. And he, you know, he was having a hard time defending killing mother polar bears, as you might imagine. And so he went back to the office, and he obviously told his staff about this and how, you know, upset I'd been. And so they, you know, went quickly and started researching the production and all this, and they discovered that, in fact, these weren't hunters killing a mother polar bear. They were scientists who were tagging a mother polar bear, and they'd, you know, shot her with a dart and put her to sleep for a while, and that's what the actual footage was. So, and his, you know, in his version, it was like, see? Nobody's killing polar bears. And I remember even at age 10 thinking, well, okay, I get that they faked this footage, but that doesn't mean that people aren't killing polar bears, you know? What, are you kidding me? So, yeah, you know, I pretty young, I started kind of splitting off. I think it all started when I was 4 years old, though. And it wasn't my father. It was my mother. I remember sitting on the floor of my bedroom playing with toys, and I had this question that had been rolling around in my mind for a while. I'd been going to Sunday school and stuff like that, and my mother came in to hang something up in my closet, and I looked up at her and said, Mommy, yes, Mommy, were Adam and Eve the first cave people or the first people as we know them today? And I remember using that phrase and feeling very proud of myself for using it. The first people as we know them today. And I remember her eyes got kind of big, like, oh my God, you know, what? And she kind of, and she decided on the first people as we know them today, you know, that was the answer. But in my mind, it was like, oh, okay, so they weren't really the first human beings then, were they? Because we had these other people before them. And right away, the whole kind of, you know, biblical mythology just kind of went like this for me. I didn't, of course, declare, you know, atheism or anything at that
four.
Point. At four.
You waited till
no,
12.
I waited another 8 years. But right away, I was thinking, huh, the world is not exactly as people pretend it is. You know, there's all this sort of, you know, discrepancies and things.
So in closing, what would you like to leave the audience with about your dad?
Well, his decency, his kindness, and the fact that he always tried his best to do the right thing for the country. But beyond that, I think we should remember that he was a human being, and all presidents that we elect are human beings. They're just like us. They have weaknesses. They have flaws, you know, mental, emotional, physical, whatever they may be. But we've got to keep that in mind. They're not icons. They're not gods. They're not special like that. They're just people. They're just human beings. And so I think that's something that's worth keeping in mind.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.